Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, Ashley and I will bring you stories, along with Brian Lynn. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, the wives of two news reporters jailed in Myanmar said on Tuesday the men were innocent and called for them to be released. A court found the reporters guilty on Monday of violating the country's Official Secrets Act. They were sentenced to 7 years in prison. Their case is seen as a test of progress toward democracy in Myanmar, which was ruled by a group of military officers until 2011. The country is also called Burma. Hua Lone, 32, and Cha So-woo, 28, work for the Reuters news agency. They were investigating the killing of villagers from the Rohingya Muslim minority by security forces when they were arrested in December 2017. The reporters told a court they were not guilty of the charges. The wives and defense lawyers spoke at a press conference in Yangon on Tuesday. Cha So-woo's wife, Chit Su-wen, said she had expected the court to clear the charges against the two men on Monday. "I believed that we would be able to go home together," she said, adding that the men were doing their jobs and are innocent. Hua Lone's wife, Pani Mon, said she wanted the reporters to be released as quickly as possible. She said she was sad that Myanmar's government leader, Aung San Suu Kyi, seemed to speak against the reporters before the ruling. Aung San Suu Kyi told Japanese television station NHK in June that the two men were not arrested for their reporting, but because they violated the Official Secrets Act. Neither the Nobel Prize winner nor her government's main spokesman have spoken about the case since the jail sentence was announced. Many Myanmar news organizations and more than 20 civil society groups denounced the court's ruling. They said the conviction was an attack on the right to freedom of information. The privately owned 7-Day Daily is one of Myanmar's most popular newspapers. Its front was all black, with words that read, "A sad day for Myanmar." The newspaper said the sentences end the hope that the current government will value and respect media freedom. It added that the government had earned a reputation for media suppression, as former military governments had done. The paper said everyone needs to know that democracy will not survive in an information dark age. Myanmar barred media interference by the government in 2012. It was part of reforms by a quasi-civilian government that led to elections in 2015. Aung San Suu Kyi's party, the National League for Democracy, won the vote. An editor of the Irrawaddy online news website said Aung San Suu Kyi and President Win Myint had to understand that the case was about the people's right to know. The editor, Cha Zwa Mo, said, "These Reuters reporters were simply doing their jobs by attempting to gather information so as to uncover the truth." The privately owned Myanmar Times showed a large picture of Cha Soo-woo wearing handcuffs as he left the court. It said the conviction was a blow to press freedom. The state-run Global New Light of Myanmar newspaper reported the conviction. It did not criticize the decision, but said the defense could appeal. The conviction comes as the United Nations said the killing of Rohingya in August 2017 was carried out by Myanmar's military. A UN report called for top generals to be tried. Myanmar rejected the report's findings. UN agencies have said more than 700,000 Rohingya Muslims have fled into Bangladesh since August of last year.
The president of USA Gymnastics, Carey Perry, resigned under pressure Tuesday. The move came days after the U.S. Olympic Committee questioned her ability to lead the organization. Perry spent 9 months as president. During that time, she faced criticism from current and former athletes over how she was dealing with issues surrounding one of America's biggest sexual abuse scandals in history. USA Gymnastics' longtime team doctor, Larry Nassar, is said to have abused more than 300 women and girls over a 30-year period. Nassar stopped working with USA Gymnastics in 2015. He is serving an effective life sentence in prison for sexually abusing patients during medical treatment and for possessing sexual images of children. When Perry took the job last December, she said her aim would be to create an environment of empowerment where all have a strong voice. But last week, USA Gymnastics faced criticism after the hiring of a coach for a high-level athlete development position. The coach, Mary Lee Tracy, publicly supported Nassar when abuse claims against him first appeared in the media 2 years ago. Tracy told one reporter that Nassar was an amazing doctor to her athletes. Her comments came after 50 women had said they were abused by Nassar. After USA Gymnastics announced Tracy's new position, several of Nassar's victims noted Tracy's early support of the former doctor. Olympic gold medalist and abuse survivor Ali Raisman wrote on Twitter, "This is a slap in the face for survivors and further confirmation that nothing at USA Gymnastics has changed." Tracy then reportedly made an effort last week to contact Raisman to apologize. USA Gymnastics answered that attempt by asking Tracy to step down. The organization said Tracy had inappropriately contacted a survivor. Raisman is one of many abuse survivors suing USA Gymnastics. The USA Gymnastics request for Tracy to resign was likely done to protect the organization legally. The move brought a new wave of negative media attention. The newly hired chief of the U.S. Olympic Committee, Sarah Hirschland, published a statement about USA Gymnastics on Friday. She wrote that it is time to consider making adjustments in the leadership. The U.S. Olympic Committee oversees USA Gymnastics and other sports governing bodies. Hirschland said the Olympic Committee would speak with USA Gymnastics representatives over the weekend. The discussion ended with Perry stepping down.
The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation is providing $92 million in assistance in a new effort to help minority and low-income students succeed. The assistance will come in the form of grants to 19 school programs across 13 American states. Many of the programs are in areas that have struggled with poverty and student performance issues. The foundation's announcement said the Networks for School Improvement program will center on middle and high school students. It is designed to have groups of schools work together to identify and solve common problems using methods that best fit their needs. A statement said the foundation chose to invest in the schools as a way to help increase the number of Black, Latino, and low-income students graduating from high school. In addition, the program is designed to prepare the students for college so they will have a better chance to succeed in life. The grants will address several different areas to help students succeed in the classroom and prepare for college. These include basic academic skills like math, English, and other subjects. But the program will also offer help in how to deal with things like school suspensions or the college application process. Bob Hughes leads the K-12 education program for the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. He told reporters the organization drew heavily on past experiences when deciding on new program plans. "We're not inventing anything in this strategy. We're taking what we learned from research and experience," Hughes said. Alan Golston is president of the foundation's U.S. program. In an opinion story for the education website The 74, Golston said the goal of the assistance is to help local school groups come up with their own solutions. "Once each network has identified a common barrier, schools will put in place strategies to tackle the problem based on what they know about their students," he wrote. Golston said the foundation's research shows that identifying and removing barriers faced by schools can make a great difference in how many students end up graduating. He added that the main goal of the foundation's education program has not changed over the years. "All students, and especially low-income students and students of color, must have equal access to a great public education that prepares them for success in adulthood. Golston said the latest assistance of $92 million is just the beginning. Over the next 5 years, the foundation expects to provide $460 million to aid dozens more schools and to help tens of thousands of students get the education they deserve. I'm Brian Lynn.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. We continue the story of America's 42nd president, Bill Clinton. He was a popular and successful president who was re-elected in 1996. But he also became only the second president in American history ever to be put on trial in Congress. Clinton's past in Arkansas became the source of accusations and questions about his character as he was running for president. These included questions about financial dealings with a land development company called Whitewater. In January of 1994, President Clinton asked Attorney General Janet Reno to appoint an independent lawyer to lead an investigation. She named a Republican, but some critics said her choice was too friendly to the Clinton administration. He was replaced by another Republican, Kenneth Starr. In 1995, the Senate Judiciary Committee began its own investigation of the president. The committee later reported that it had not found evidence of any crimes. However, because the committee was led by Democrats, there was continuing suspicion of the president among Republicans. The main cause of that suspicion dated back to a purchase of land in Arkansas years earlier. Bill and Hillary Clinton had bought the land in 1978, the year he was first elected governor of that state. The Clintons formed the Whitewater Development Company with Susan and James McDougal. The goal was to sell vacation homes along a river. However, the company did poorly. James McDougal also owned Madison Guarantee Savings and Loan, for which Hillary Clinton did legal work. Madison failed during the 1980s. The McDougals were found guilty of wrongdoing in connection with that failure. A former local judge in Little Rock, the state capital, also became part of the story. In 1994, David Hale pleaded guilty to charges of cheating the federal government. That case was in connection with a lending company he owned and was not connected to Whitewater. But Hale accused Bill Clinton of having pressured him while governor to loan money to Susan McDougal and other politically influential people. Clinton denied the accusations. During the president's first term, investigators sought billing records for Hillary Clinton's past legal work for James McDougal. They wanted to know, in connection with the Whitewater investigation, how much time she had spent on that work. The First Lady said she could not find the records. Then, in January of 1996, the billing records appeared without explanation in the White House. That mystery only added to the suspicions of some Americans. Others thought Kenneth Starr was just wasting taxpayer money on his investigation of the Clintons. They felt it was just for political reasons. The Whitewater investigation became increasingly complex and difficult to follow. In the end, President Clinton was never charged with any wrongdoing in connection with his financial dealings. But his legal problems did not stop there. In 1994, a former Arkansas state employee named Paula Jones sued President Clinton. She brought a civil action accusing him of sexual harassment while governor of Arkansas. In her lawsuit, she said he had asked her for sex. A federal judge dismissed her case for lack of evidence. Paula Jones appealed that ruling. Her lawyers said they wanted to prove that Clinton had a pattern of such behavior with female employees, including while president. They suspected that these included a 21-year-old woman named Monica Lewinsky. Lewinsky had worked as an unpaid intern in the White House. Kenneth Starr was still investigating the Whitewater case early in 1998. He received permission to include Lewinsky in his investigation.
Hi, how'd you know it was me?
Same caller ID.
Oh, what's it say?
Linda Tripp.
A former friend of Monica Lewinsky, Linda Tripp, had given Starr tape recordings of her telephone conversations with the younger woman.
I hate him.
No, you don't. You hate his behavior at times.
In the recordings, Lewinsky talked about her relationship with the president. What she told Linda Tripp conflicted with the information she gave to lawyers for Paula Jones. She had told them that the relationship had not been sexual. Lawyers for Paula Jones also questioned President Clinton. He, too, denied that the relationship with Monica Lewinsky had been sexual. On January 26, 1998, the president stated his denial to the American public.
But I want to say one thing to the American people. I want you to listen to me. I'm going to say this again. I did not have sexual relations with that woman, Miss Lewinsky. I never told anybody to lie. Not a single time, never. These allegations are false, and I need to go back to work for the American people.
Later in the year, the president agreed to answer questions before a federal grand jury.
The opening statement I made is that I had inappropriate, intimate contact. I take full responsibility for it. It wasn't her fault, it was mine. I do not believe that I violated the definition of sexual relations I was given by directly touching those parts of her body with the intent to arouse or gratify. And that's all I have to say.
This was the first time an investigating jury had ever called a president to testify while in office.
This afternoon in this room, from this chair, I testified before the Office of Independent Counsel and the grand jury. I answered their questions truthfully, including questions about my private life, questions no American citizen would ever want to answer. Still, I must take complete responsibility for all my actions, both public and private. And that is why I am speaking to you tonight.
After his appearance, the president went on national television and admitted the nature of his relationship with Monica Lewinsky.
As you know, in a deposition in January, I was asked questions about my relationship with Monica Lewinsky. While my answers were legally accurate, I did not volunteer information. Indeed, I did have a relationship with Ms. Lewinsky that was not appropriate. In fact, it was wrong.
He said his actions were a personal failure, but he denied trying to get her to lie about the relationship.
But I told the grand jury today, and I say to you now, that at no time did I ask anyone to lie, to hide or destroy evidence, or to take any other unlawful action. I know that my public comments and my silence about this matter gave a false impression. I misled people, including even my wife. I deeply regret that.
Kenneth Starr sent his final report to the House of Representatives. The report suggested that President Clinton may have committed impeachable crimes in trying to hide his relationship with Monica Lewinsky. In the United States, to impeach a president means to bring charges in the House of Representatives. The charges result in removal from office if the president is found guilty in a trial in the Senate. The Chief Justice of the United States serves as the judge, and the senators serve as the jury. In December of 1998, the House of Representatives voted to impeach President Clinton. The House sent the charges to the Senate to hold a trial. The two articles of impeachment accused him of lying to a federal grand jury and obstructing justice. Only one other president had ever been impeached. In 1868, the House of Representatives brought charges against Andrew Johnson. The case related to his removal of a cabinet member. The Senate held a trial, but Andrew Johnson's presidency survived by one vote. The threat of impeachment led President Richard Nixon to resign in 1974 over his cover-up of political wrongdoing in the Watergate case.
It is up to the members of the House of Representatives to vote their conscience on the Constitution and the law, which I believe are clear. And I have no intention of resigning. It's never crossed my mind.
Bill Clinton still had 2 years left as president. In public opinion surveys, two-thirds of the people said they opposed removing him from office.
What I want the American people to know, what I want the Congress to know, is that I am profoundly sorry for all I have done wrong in words and deeds. I never should have misled the country, the Congress, my friends, or my family. Quite simply, I gave in to my shame. I have been condemned by my accusers with harsh words. And while it's hard to hear yourself called deceitful and manipulative, I remember Ben Franklin's admonition that our critics are our friends, for they do show us our faults.
The Senate decided President Clinton's future in February of 1999. The 100 senators held a trial to consider the charges and decide if he should be removed from office. Each charge required 67 votes to find him guilty. 10 members of the Republican majority joined Democrats in voting to clear Clinton of the perjury charge. The Senate was evenly divided on the charge of interfering with justice, thus no guilty verdict. Bill Clinton remained president of the United States. As a historical footnote, as it turned out, Republican House Speaker Newt Gingrich was himself cheating on his wife while leading the impeachment action against President Clinton. The difference, Gingrich would say years later, was that Clinton was charged with lying after he legally swore to tell the truth. In October 1999, Kenneth Starr resigned as the independent counsel. An assistant, Robert Ray, completed a final report on the Whitewater investigation. He issued his report in September 2000. The report said there was not enough evidence to prove any wrongdoing by Bill or Hillary Clinton.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.